Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The troubling practice of sterilizing women without their consent seems like a medieval practice from a bygone era. In fact, it was a misguided policy by some medical institutions decades ago, carried out on indigenous women more often than other populations. Groups of women around the world are now speaking up on the last repercussions of past sterilizations and confronting more recent instances that keep cropping up. We'll talk about it after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Federal infrastructure dollars are making their way to the Pine Ridge Reservation. The money will go toward the Oglala Dam, which has been out of commission for some time. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene reports.
The dam failed about 5 years ago. Representatives from the Interior Department were on hand this week to break ground on the new development. Putting the dam back into use will help mitigate floods in lower elevation communities and rebuild the lake ecosystem in the area. Brian Newland is the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. Newland says it's an example of real investment in reservations from the Biden administration.
We're putting our money where our mouth is when it comes to things like this. Serving all Americans, including American Indian people and tribes and communities that are so often overlooked.
Local tribal representatives on hand said they were happy to see real steps being taken. That includes Water Resources Director Reno Redcloud.
We could see that, you know, there's improvements coming to our tribe. It's an improvement for us to move forward for another 60, 70 years.
The dam was first built in the 1940s and was taken out of commission following a severe flood. I'm C.J. Keene in Oglala.
The U.S. and Canada have struck a deal over pollution flowing from British Columbia coal mines into a lake and river system in Montana. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains.
Tribes in the U.S. and Canada have raised concerns for years about selenium levels harming fish reproduction in Lake Coconusa and the Kootenai River. That selenium is flowing from coal mines along the Elk River in British Columbia. Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Chairman Tom McDonald says the pollution puts cutthroat trout and threatened species like bull trout at risk.
We have to be able to have a clean and healthy environment that we can catch fish and be able to eat fish out of any river system that's in our Aboriginal territory that we've relied on for the past 10 to 30,000 years.
The U.S. and Canada agreed to let the International Joint Commission set up a governing body for the transboundary watershed. That body will make recommendations for provincial, state, and federal governments. While not legally binding, IJC recommendations are usually implemented. Teck Resources, which owns the mines, says it wants to learn more about the IJC process, but noted it's willing to work with all parties. BC provincial officials released a statement saying they support IJC involvement. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A new poll suggests that Manitoba's new Indigenous premier, Wab Kanew, has the highest approval rating among Canadian premiers. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, it's a sharp difference from his predecessor, who ranked last in four previous polls.
It's apparent that the honeymoon phase between Manitoba voters and Premier Wab Kanew is far from over. The latest Angus Reid poll shows Kanew with an approval rating of 57%, and more than 20% of them say they strongly approve. Kanew of the New Democratic Party campaigned for the October election on the promise of fixing health care and making life more affordable for Manitobans.
So today is a new day in our province, and people are feeling very optimistic about the future, and now it's up to our administration to deliver.
Chris Adams is an adjunct professor of political studies.
You don't want to hang your hat too strongly on these numbers, but at the same time, it's good to compare this premier to the other premiers. Knowing the polling data from the past number of years, it's the first time Manitoba's premier has been so high up in the numbers.
At the same time, Adams says Kanew has made some commitments that might be difficult to keep, and he adds that he would be surprised if the current numbers hold. But he says many Manitobans are feeling a sense of optimism. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. A bill just introduced in Canada would outlaw what most of the developed world has considered a human rights violation for decades. The law would prohibit sterilizing women without their consent. This comes after a government report found hundreds of indigenous women were sterilized during the 1960s and 70s, and at least 20 more up until 2019. Some First Nations women are speaking out about their experiences. The Canadian effort comes as other women around the globe are confronting past and current procedures carried out disproportionately on Indigenous women. For example, Inuit women in Greenland are demanding compensation from the Danish government for sterilizations there. We'll take a look this hour at the problem of sterilization without consent, and we'd like to hear from our listeners as well. Do you have women in your family or among your friends who were subjected to unwanted reproductive procedures? Call us at 1-800-996-2848. Our first guest is joining us from Saskatoon in Saskatchewan, Canada, Morningstar McCready. She is a traditional oratory storyteller, and she is from the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. Hello, McCready. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi. Yes, McCready is my surname. My first name is Morningstar. And greetings to you all the way from Treaty 6 territory up here in Canada. I'm from Treaty 8 territory. Pleasure to be talking to you today, despite the topic.
Right, Morningstar. Appreciate you joining us very much. And it is going to be a difficult conversation, so we just want to give our listeners a heads up with that regard. Also on our show today, Madonna Thunderhawk. She is a community worker with Standing Strong Grandmothers, and she is Lakota. Madonna, welcome back to NAC. You've been a guest many times.
Thank you. It's an honor joining to be here.
It's an honor to have you, Madonna, certainly, along with our other guests. And let's introduce our third guest, Anne Pilegaard-Petersen. She is joining us from Copenhagen, Denmark. And she is the co-host, along with Celine Klint, of The Spiral Campaign, which is a podcast that addresses the forced sterilizations of Greenlandic women. Welcome to our show, Anne.
Thank you so much, and thank you for taking an interest in this topic as well, even though it's a bit further away than Canada and America.
Just a bit, Anne, just a bit. But through the wonders of modern technology, we have you here as part of our discussion, and I can't wait to collect your insights for our listeners. One more guest is joining us on the line, Gusanio Kick, who joins us from the Six Nations in Ontario, Canada. She is a multidisciplinary artist and a sterilization survivor. She is from the Mohawk Nation Wolf Clan. Gusanio, welcome to you as well to Native America Calling.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Let's go ahead and get our conversation started now. And in today's intro, we noted that there is legislation in Canada to outlaw sterilizations without a woman's consent. Some of our listeners might find it hard to believe that here we are in the year 2024, there would even be a need for a law like this. So, Morningstar, please kick us off and explain how this legal effort applies to you.
Well, I too am a survivor of sterilization, and my concern, obviously, with this is that it become criminalized, which Senator Yvonne Boyer has gone through the second reading of Bill S-250. It has to go through another reading and then to the House of Commons. Should the Bill S-250, and I'm knocking on wood here, I'm saying that when it's passed, being optimistic, that a practitioner who sterilizes First Nations, Métis, Inuit, or woman of color through coercion or without her consent, which is forced, will face up to 14 years of incarceration, which certainly would deter any practitioners, presumably. I also wanted to say that with the various forms of sterilization that are ongoing, this is not historical. This is not past tense. Pardon me. It is historical. It's historical in the context of sterilizations have been going on systemically within the Indian hospitals up here in Canada, as well as in residential schools. So in historical context, this has been going on for as long as those institutions have been in place. And as recently as 2022, I believe, though as we speak, there is no doubt in my mind, somewhere on Turtle Island, a woman or girl is being subjected to this. Now, the various forms of sterilization also need to be determined, because historically, hysterectomies were one of the forms that Indigenous women were told that they had to have these procedures. And it wasn't just one generation. It was a mother. It was a daughter. Recently in 2021 in Vancouver, Breen Ouellette, a Vancouver-based Métis lawyer, made the claim that social workers in British Columbia forced Indigenous children under the age of 10 to have IUDs inserted by doctors. I really need to emphasize that this is ongoing, which is why Bill S-250 is so critical. There's so much more that needs to be said and can be said in terms of the historical context of how this sterilizations of Indigenous peoples occurred and began. That's another topic in itself. I do want to say to the to your listeners, to any women or men, because men have also been sterilized, to any of the women out there that may have been sterilized themselves, I want to extend to you from my heart, from my spirit, my condolences, and that I want to say you're not alone. I know personally, being a survivor of sterilization, that I have PTSD as a result of the flashbacks that occurred when I heard about sterilization on CBC Radio, actually. One of the women were being interviewed that is a part of a litigation here in Canada, and there are several litigations. So it isn't a small number of women. There are hundreds. I mean, presently, that are a part of various litigations in Canada. The numbers, if we could never accurately determine these numbers of women and generations that have been sterilized. Mm-hmm. There is a number out there of approximately 1,200 women. Now, that's based on Karen Stout's research. Now, if we do the math, of the 1,200 hypothetical number, because we know that it exceeds hundreds of thousands, is what I would venture to say, that generationally, one woman on average would have 4 to 6 children. So they have effectively ended lineages that are lineages of our people, Indigenous people, that have been here since time immemorial. So back to the women out there, I do need to say this. If indeed you feel that you have been sterilized, know that you're not alone, that if it's possible to definitely create a support system around yourself, if you feel that you need to disclose, you need to talk about it, I would really encourage anyone to do so, but to do so with a support base around you.
Morning, sir. I think a lot of our listeners, and myself included, are maybe struggling a little bit just to comprehend just how, like we said in the introduction, it just sounds medieval that you know, in our lifetimes, not only has this occurred, but it's still occurring. And maybe if you could just explain for our listeners, like how does this happen? What goes on in a hospital in which a Native woman goes in for some type of treatment or some type of procedure, and she comes out sterilized? Like, how does that happen? And perhaps how did it happen for you, if you're comfortable sharing?
Well, how it happens basically is a woman who is pregnant, primarily that's been the predominant circumstance involved, in her most vulnerable state, is going to the hospital to have her baby. There have been incidences here in Canada where this woman who is about to give birth is threatened by the practitioner or a social worker. In Canada, we have what's called the birth alert. So Indigenous women that go to hospitals here, they're identified as visibly Indigenous, or healthcare card has identifies them as Indigenous women. There is a birth alert. We're told that the birth alerts are no longer in place, but we know that it's still a practice. So, first of all, if she's visibly Indigenous, if she's identified as Indigenous through her healthcare card, she is pregnant, she's going to the hospital, the birth alert is immediately put in place. For any reason, any bias, which is usually based on racism, that a practitioner or a social worker feels they have the right to instigate this birth alert. There actually has been a woman, and I don't think it's in isolation, where she was told that unless she agreed to being sterilized to obligation, her children would be apprehended, including her baby.
Okay, so that's where the threat comes in. Morningstar, I'm sorry, we're going to have to take a short break here, but this is just so disturbing, listening to you just share these experiences there in Canada. And we've got other guests on our show today who are going to provide perspectives not only in Canada, but also in the United States and also in Greenland. So encourage all of our listeners, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you would like to learn more from our guests or have any specific questions, give us a call. We've got the phone lines open right now, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Native Americans are more likely to die from liver disease than other populations, but they are less likely to land on a list of people approved for life-saving transplants. Those conclusions come from a new investigation published in the Washington Post. We'll hear about discrepancies for liver transplants on the next Native America Calling.
The Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects authentic American Indian and Alaska Native artists and craftspeople and their art and craftwork. Under the Act, it is illegal to market art or craftwork misrepresented as American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Alaska Native made, or as the product of a particular Indian tribe. Reporting potential Act violations can be done at doi.gov/IACB or at 1-888-ART-FAKE. Support provided by Indian Arts and Crafts Board.
You are listening to Native America Calling, and today we are talking about forced sterilization of Indigenous women. Do you think there needs to be accountability, additional accountability, or perhaps compensation for some of these victims? Or if you know someone subjected to unwanted procedures, you're welcome to share your story with us today, but of course only if you feel comfortable doing so. We realize this is a difficult and emotionally charged topic. Our number to the studio is 1-800-996-2848. The number again, 1-800-996-2848. Our first guest, Morningstar McCready, is up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And Morningstar, before we had to take that break there, you were talking about just how this happens and how young or perhaps middle-aged women as well are threatened in some cases, children, the threat of children being apprehended, birth alerts. Please continue what you were describing before we move on to our next guest, Madonna Thunderhawk.
Yes, indeed. Birth alerts here in Canada, again, presumably were stopped, but of course we all know that they continue. I think it's really important to keep in perspective and context that this is ongoing. We're in the 21st century. This is happening now. The various forms of how this is happening ultimately is up to the practitioner performing this. In 2022, there was a doctor in Yellowknife that sterilized an Inuit woman. If Bill S-250 was in place, he would be incarcerated right now. As it is, he wasn't incarcerated. His hand was slapped. He's now practicing in British Columbia somewhere. So the process differs when you put it in historical context, presumably, again, back to what happened in British Columbia in 2021, where social workers were having children, Indigenous children, 10 years and younger, having them placed with IUDs. 2021. Now, if you go back historically and you look at Indian hospitals, and there were many here in Canada, one of the ones in Alberta, for example, Charles Campbell Indian Hospital had up to 500 beds there. There was an Indian hospital in British Columbia that was renowned for the horrific experimentations of the children there. So historically, if you put it in context, in the sense of Indian hospitals and residential schools, it's important to honor our ancestors and those that have been subjected to these experiments and sterilizations. We'll never know the numbers. Those files, medical files and records have been destroyed. Now you bring it back to the 21st century, this is ongoing. It hasn't stopped. And for each individual that is either coerced or forced, she is. When a woman is in the fit of labor, you do not present to this woman a paper of coercion for her to sign while she's about to give birth. She's in no frame of mind, first of all, and there has to be a process in place. That has yet to be determined. There's so much that is weighing on Bill S-250 moving forward and being passed, because that change and that accountability needs to be put in place as a safeguard for Indigenous women. Otherwise, it'll continue.
All right. Morningstar, thanks again for leading off our discussion and really putting a fine point on just the importance and more than anything, just the tragedy that you're describing today and what we're learning about. Let's bring Gusanillo into our conversation now. She is a multidisciplinary artist and also a sterilization survivor. And Gusanillo, please, if you would, share your experience. Is it similar to what we heard Morningstar describe for you?
Yeah, so I was quite young when the when I had undergone coerced sterilization. I was 16 years old, which, looking back on it now, I'm 16 is such a baby. And so I was technically still a child, and I was going in for a scheduled C-section of my youngest daughter. And leading up to the delivery of my daughter, I had the doctor had engaged in a conversation about birth control with me, and had brought up sterilization, but had misrepresented what the procedure was. And I had repeatedly asked, like, well, it can be reversed and those types of things. And it wasn't until much, much later that I had realized the permanency of what had been done. And again, this practice of you know, well, I'm already going to be in there anyways. And so, you know, we might as well go ahead with the procedure. And I had actually had a adverse reaction to one of the medications during my C-section. And so I was vomiting profusely throughout the procedure, and medically was not in any position to be able to say yes or no.
Gustanillo, a quick question. Were you threatened in any way, like we heard Morningstar describe some women have been threatened in Canada?
There wasn't direct threat. It was definitely, there was definitely like a level of misleading and racism as well, because this was the my second child that I was having at such a young age.
So now here we are, you were 16 years old, and as you described, you were very, very young, a teenager. That was almost 20 years ago. What's been the impact in your life now, and as you look back on living now, that was more than half your life ago, and at least you are a mother, but how does this make you feel now, looking back?
There's a lot of anger and sadness and grief. I think it's important to understand when we're talking about forced sterilization, we're like, this doesn't just impact me. It impacts my children that I do have. It impacts my mother being able to be a grandmother. It impacts my sisters being able to be aunties. And it also affects like my nation, because as women and like womb carrying people, like when we have the ability to be mothers, like we are literally raising generations, mm-hmm. and we're raising nations, and we're tasked with that responsibility of the health of the nation. And so this like directly impacts my nation and my clan as well. And, you know, I really feel like there are children that were supposed to be here that had gifts,
right,
contribute that aren't able to be here.
Yeah, I mean, the ripple effects here could play out for generations to come within your family, Gustanillo. I also want to ask you, I mean, somebody listening today might be thinking like, well, geez, you know, why didn't they just suggest like an IUD or some other type of contraceptive that they, you know, there while you're in the hospital? I mean, were any other options other than sterilization, were any other options suggested or offered?
Other options were offered, but it was very like, you're not responsible enough to take the pill every day. You're not responsible enough to come in for a birth control shot. And this will just like ensure that you won't have more like unplanned pregnancies, basically.
Okay. Gee whiz. Okay. Well, Gustanillo, one silver lining here is that you are now sharing your experiences, you're sharing your story through your artwork. Please tell us more about that and what you are doing to make a difference with this issue.
Yeah. So I have recently received a grant to do a photo series looking at this topic of forced sterilization. And so basically the concept is I'm creating a textile figure to represent the children that I didn't have. And the photo series is going to be of like me and this textile representation kind of interacting with each other. And yeah, I just, as an artist, this has been a topic that's really been kind of at the back of my mind. It's taken me a really long time to come to terms with the permanency of what was done to me. And to be quite honest, I feel like I'm still grappling with that. And so to be able to process this through art and community support, and being able to share my story in a way that we'll be able to engage with people on a different level, because it is such a heavy topic. It is, I feel like people don't really know how to interact with it, how to hold it, how to hold space for it, what they're supposed to feel. And so it's difficult to get people to talk about and to educate. And so my hope is that this art project will be able to create the space for people to engage in this very difficult conversation and topic.
I hope it will too, very much. And Gusnia, one more question before we move on to our next guest. You are part of a lawsuit. Please tell us more about that and what you hope to accomplish.
So I'm actually not a part of any of the lawsuits. There are numerous lawsuits ongoing throughout Canada, and Ontario has recently changed some of their class action status laws. So currently, Ontario is one of the only provinces that does not have an ongoing lawsuit for this issue.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. And also just thank you for coming on the show today and sharing your story. I really, really admire you, your bravery and just your faith. And you're really inspiring to hear you talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. You bet. We're going to bring Madonna Thunderhawk into our conversation now. And again, she is a community worker with Standing Strong Grandmothers. And Madonna, thank you again for joining our show. And in contrast to Canada, there doesn't appear to be an ongoing forced sterilization problem here in the U.S. However, in the 70s, it took advocacy to bring public attention to the issue and stop these procedures. Tell us about your role in that advocacy and the group you worked with.
Yeah, okay, well, thank you for having me. Yeah, it took, of course, community work and community attention, you know, on a local level, because we could see what was going on. And basically it was to get, you know, get policies changed within the Indian Health Service, you know, IHS. So that's basically what we did. But it started locally, you know, what was going on locally with our women. And so, yeah, we did get policies changed and all that. But now, you know, but it's ongoing. Like, you know, now the issue is not sterilization anymore. It's, the main thing is the IHS doesn't do deliveries on the local IHS hospitals. They're just glorified clinics now. They send all the young women off-reservation hospitals where it's C-sections now. There's no such thing as natural childbirth anymore. So that's the next issue. You know, it's the whole sacredness of childbirth in our ways, our traditional ways, is gone. you know, and so, and as a grandmothers group, we have two levels of grandmothers. We have the YGs, the young grandmothers that are raising grandchildren. We have the OGs, the old grandmothers. That's us, you know. We go to all the meetings and stuff, you know. So we cover all issues, you know, that come up from the community. So, you know, the health and welfare of our people is just one of them, many issues, you know. So, and we found out over the years for us OGs that change only happens when the community gets organized and, you know, takes it on. So we're spread pretty thin here, you know, on my reservation at least. But, yeah, we keep an eye on what's going on, especially with the young mothers to be, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine, Madonna, and you've been doing this type of work for decades now, and you've been working on the grassroots level. And it's interesting, you know, you note just the role of the Indian Health Service and how that's changed with regard to deliveries being outsourced to other hospitals and how that plays into some of these issues as well. So we're going to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more with Madonna. And we also have our fourth guest on the line, Anne Pilegaard Petersen, who will be joining us from Denmark to talk about the issues there in Greenland that she has uncovered with some of her work as part of her podcast. So listeners, stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our phone lines are open and we'll get you on the air. We'll share your comments. 1-800-996-2848.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's AMERIND.com.
You have attuned to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we're talking about forced or coerced sterilization, taking away a woman's ability to have children without her informed approval. That's what happened to many Native women in the 1960s and 70s as a response to misguided policies. Unfortunately, the process continues, though on a smaller scale, into these later years. There's still time to join the conversation. 1-800-996-2848. Our current guest on the line, Madonna Thunderhawk, talking about how this issue came to a head in the 1970s and 1980s in the United States. And Madonna, what first got you involved in this type of work and doing this advocacy?
Well, okay. There was always talk about it. We kind of had an idea, you know, these things were happening, but there was so much of other things going on, our water rights struggles and, you know, land issues and that kind of thing. So, but one of the things that was happening, one of our members of our group was taking nurses training on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And she said, she let us know, she said she went in, their training was at where they had to do their clinicals, where they had to go into the hospital and actually work on the floors and stuff. So she said she went in and the hallway was full of beds and there were all women and the rooms were all filled. So she asked, you know, what happened, what's going on? They said, well, we really don't know. The, you know, powers that be, the doc, head doctor, whoever, said, we really don't know, but these women are losing their babies from anywhere from 2 to 4 months, you know, when they're pregnant. So she said, we're just calling it spontaneous abortions. You know, so that kind of brought up the issue of the whole thing of childbirth. And we did do a study, a water study. We did find out that the water on Pine Ridge is contaminated by radiation contamination from mining back in the 50s and whatever. The watersheds were contaminated. So we found, but that kind of alerted us to what was, you know, going on. And later we realized that there was so much of the sterilization going on. And one of the IHS people that, I mean, that on a higher level, in Washington, had worked on that level was Dr. Urey, Dr. Connie Urey, and she told us what was going on, that it was policy. But I just, so that's when we took on the issue. And we're only local, community, you know, local on a reservation. But you know, you just organize and you do what you can for your people. You start out at the local level, and that as a result, we change the policy, the national policy, you know, for sterilization. But we always have to keep hold our, you know, ear to the ground, because you never know what the government policies are going to do, whether they're IHS or whatever, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, as you describe, I mean, it just the way things change and the way issues change. And, you know, this also ties into the whole issue of the Indian adoption program as well. And, you know, how those, I'd imagine some of these women and, you know, who came in for these procedures, maybe after having children, maybe those children were ultimately adopted out, you know, without their approval as well. So just a lot of layers to this whole issue. And Madonna, thank you also for joining us and sharing your insights. Let's bring Anne Pilegaard-Petersen into our conversation now from Copenhagen. And on your podcast, you've covered the forced sterilization issue in Greenland. Please provide some background for our listeners.
Yeah, I definitely will. Thank you. And I'll also like to say that English is my first language. So if I don't get the terminology right, then I'm sorry and excuse me beforehand.
Well, your English sounds great to me, Anne. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I'm a Dane, so I'm quite interested and have been that for a while as a journalist in the Danish-Greenlandic relationship. And I don't know if your listeners know this, but Greenland used to be a Danish colony and then later in the 50s became sort of a county in Denmark. And this whole story, for me at least, started because two very brave and amazing women, Nea Lybert and Marie Rasmussen, came forward in a Greenlandic newspaper and told the story about how they got an IUD that was forced on them when they were approximately 13 and 14. It was during a health checkup by the school physician that they were told to go to the doctor and get this IUD. And I think that in the Danish-Greenlandic relationship is, I don't know if it's completely the same where you guys are from, but Danes were the teachers, Danes were the doctors, so they had this huge authority. So these two very young girls didn't feel that they in any way could decline, say no. And now, almost 50 years later, they're wondering, why did we have to have this IUD and were we the only ones? And that made me and a colleague, Celine Klint, look into this. And what we found out was basically that the Danish government had this whole IUD campaign, it was called, during the end of the 60s until the start of the 70s. So it was 5 years. And during that period of time, it was almost 4,500 Greenlandic women in the fertile age that got an IUD. And there were only 9,000 women all in all. So basically, it was around 50% of all Greenlandic women that got an IUD during this period.
Okay.
And
yeah,
that's a crazy number.
It really is, because like we heard from two of our guests already, you know, what are the ramifications of this for the population of a group? So, I mean, the Inuit population there in Greenland, how has it been impacted in these years since? I would imagine the population's probably dropped dramatically.
Exactly. So that is actually what one of the professors in this Arctic healthcare who had looked into this said, that you could see the child rate dropped to almost half. So he said, this is basically what we see when a disaster hits a nation or a group of people, like this is what you would see. So it had a dramatic, huge effect. And
as I said before, these two women were very young. They were 13 and 14. Some girls were even younger, 12 years. And because of the IUD that was used back then, that's called a lipase loop, that's made of plastic and not, a coil made of metal or anything else. But because this one was used, some of the girls, and the wrong size was used, some of the girls became infertile. They couldn't have children afterwards because it ruined, in a way, their uterus. So this whole idea of this IUD being something that you could remove and then it wouldn't have any consequences, that was completely wrong, and it had huge consequences, not only on the bigger scale on the whole population, but also for like the individuals that this happened to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what we looked into. And what has been very amazing is that, no, it sounds wrong to use these words in that context, but right now it's almost, I think it's 130 or 143 women that are right now suing the Danish state for what happened back then. Because what we also found out covering this story was that the story in Denmark is always that we were the good colonizers, that we did this because a lot of the policies that we did in Greenland was because they needed to become more like us. They needed to become Danified. They need to become a modern society. And with this COIL campaign and the whole history around this, it wasn't about the girls becoming young mothers. It was also very much a question about economics, that they were coming more and more of the children were surviving because of a healthcare system. More and more children had to go to school. They had to have to build new houses. So it was very expensive for the Danish government to actually do all of this stuff in Greenland. And that was also part of the motivation for this COIL campaign. So it sent a huge shockwave, not only in Greenland, but also in Denmark when this story came out, because suddenly, at least here in Denmark, we had to look at ourselves in the mirror and said, okay, this story that's been told forever and ever, it's not right at all. And these women who are now suing the Danish state, they're just doing this on their own. And it's amazing that we're actually held accountable for what we did back then. So it sent quite some shock ripples. But one of the things that I'm so happy about, and again, perhaps it's a wrong word, but Naya Lübert, who is one of the women who was first to come forward, she's also a psychiatrist, and she's done this huge, amazing work of actually bringing all of these women together, not only to sue the state, but also to have group therapy. So they call themselves the COIL sisters. And they meet up in Nuuk, the capital in Greenland, and also online and talk to each other and help each other and share their stories, because this happens to so many women all over. And they've also gotten the Greenlandic Minister of Health to secure them psychiatrists or help to talk about this. So It's a horrible story, but that Naya and Maria came forward has really meant that this is something that are right now actually being, I don't know what to say, but it's something that's been brought forth. And right now it seems like a lot of the women, even though it's a tough thing to go through and to have to face, it still seems like this is really an important conversation that's going on in Greenland and also here in Denmark.
Yeah, it really is. Really an important conversation. And Anna, I really appreciate you joining us and sharing these insights there with regard to what has happened there in Greenland. So thank you again for joining us. We're going to take another call. We've got time for one caller here on the show today, Toshina, who's listening in Barnum, Minnesota. Hello, Toshina, and welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, hi. Hi. I have just been, I listen to my radio. I really like the weekend radio shows that you guys have. And I was, I had my children within the last 10 years. And I know that throughout my pregnancies, I did kind of had children very close together. And they tried to pressure. I could feel it, you know. I could really just feel it. They tried to pressure me into an IUD and stuff like that. And my body did not accept it. And so it was taken out. And I, of course, became pregnant again. And throughout my pregnancy, they kept telling me that, you know, I was at risk going forward. And my children were at risk. You know, they kept telling me that. And, you know, me and my children's father, we talked about it, and we didn't want it, you know, and we kept pushing it away. And when I had my last child, when I went in, that we had a complication, and they asked me, they told me they needed to perform an emergency cesarean. And I was distraught. I was completely distraught. And oh, I know geez. That they had already given me. They had already given me the medicine. They had gave me the medicine, and they said, "We're about to go in. Do you want this?" You know, and I was so scared. I was just so scared for my child, and I told them yes.
And, oh, jeez.
And they tied my tubes, and you know, I was in my 20s. I was in my, you know, late 20s, okay. And.
Toshina, I'm sorry, I just have a quick question, and I had a similar question for other guest, Gusanillo. Was there anybody with you there at the time to advocate on your behalf, a relative, your husband, anybody?
No. During my pregnancy, my husband was there he was there to kind of have my back. So when I went into the doctor's office, I had that, and I kept telling him no. But when I had the cesarean, we had four children at home. I had to be brought in by ambulance, so he stayed home with our children, and I was there alone. And I didn't really realize it, you know. I never knew that this was a thing. I thought it was, I, you know, I kind of thought I was alone. I'm not totally alone, but minimal women, you know. This wasn't an issue.
All right. Well, Toshina, I really appreciate you sharing. And again, your bravery in just coming on the show and talking about this here in the United States and recently as well. So that just really makes it just so much more impactful. I want to go back to Morningstar here. Morningstar, we have about a minute before we have to wrap up, but I want to give you the last word. Just put a fine point again on our conversation. And I also understand you've got a book coming out soon. Tell us about that. Just about a minute before we got to wrap up.
Yeah, thank you. The book is Sacred Bundles Unborn. The second edition will be coming out. There are several survivors in it, several allies and advocates that are speaking to sterilization. And I wanted to thank the caller. I just wanted to say that I don't often talk about this, but I'm going to. I was 13 years old when I was pregnant because of a rape. I was 14 years old when they delivered my baby via C-section, early birth. To date, I don't know what happened to my baby. I was butchered, essentially, is what a gynecologist said many years later, from the scar tissue damage for when they removed part of my uterus. I was blessed to become pregnant at 16. Then they put an IUD in me without my consent or knowledge, and I had an ectopic. I had the IUD removed because my body rejected it, and at 19, I had an ectopic pregnancy. I flatlined, revived me. I've been not able to conceive, obviously, because I don't have the parts in my uterus anymore. All so, right. You know, it comes from a place of sacredness.
Right, right. Morningstar, I want to thank you as well, your bravery, sharing your story along with all of our other guests on the show today. We're going to have to wrap it up. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we'll be back next week with another lineup of conversations and topics. And I want to give a big shout out to our crew at Native America Calling and also our parent company, Quantic Broadcast Corporation, for another great week of content. Thank you, listeners.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at Save History.
Hey, it's February and American Heart Month. Don't ya you ya na ito na I kwani kina te don yam tema kwe kokshunawa. Ike na weaka takwenu lawa kona yo e a les na ke don yam asa shina don yante kunashna atekena. Yam don aqua mos awa shua to ta iston healthcare.gov in awa na ta iston 1-800-318-2596 na pena na kena tu. Look your sentence for Medicare and Medicaid services don na pena ito lo kena we. Elakwa.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.